Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentuckians and West Virginians learn the state of their states.
A tax modernization proposal with specific recommendations on how to move our tax system into the 21st century.
50 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty.
It looked like helicopters landing in Vietnam or something when they came over the ridge.
We traveled 219 to some West Virginia towns with unique histories.
The dream was workers or farmers placed on productive agricultural land could raise crops and food for subsistence.
And visit the classroom of West Virginia's Teacher of the Year.
Think about how you would feel if you had to get up and leave your home.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Legislators across Appalachia have gone back to work, and many governors have delivered their State of the State addresses, including Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. WEKU's Stu Johnson reports from Frankfort.
During the last year, Governor Beshear says the Commonwealth made national headlines with health care reforms, such as its expansion of Medicaid and the creation of an online marketplace for medical insurance. Its economic recovery has included significant business growth, but if the legislature can overhaul the tax code and enhance revenues, Beshear says the economic picture will brighten further.
I will present to you this session a tax modernization proposal with specific recommendations on how to move our tax system into the 21st century.
While waiting to hear more specifics from the governor, Senate President Robert Stivers noted after the speech, a revenue-neutral plan would stand the best chance. It means raising taxes for some people and lowering them for others. The Republican leader says such reforms would still bring more money into state coffers.
We would have more revenues because more people are working and more people are paying taxes. That, to me, is a good tax code.
Stivers' counterpart in the House, Speaker Greg Stumbo, says many people view tax reform as something they can support unless it increases their tax burden. The Democratic leader also believes there is a way to adjust the tax system and collect more money for state government.
I think there is a way forward. By lowering the individual rates, by lowering perhaps the corporate rates, if you spread the base. And if you spread the base, it does allow for growth.
Expanding the tax base could mean levying taxes on certain services, which are currently exempt. Senate Majority Floor Leader Damon Thayer says the challenge is significant to reform taxes or expand gambling. Instead of preparing the way for those issues, Thayer says the governor allowed himself to be distracted by other issues.
It looks to me like he's going to back off and take another swing at tax reform and expanded gambling, which is interesting because he spent most of the year implementing Obamacare and not laying the groundwork for any major policies during this session, like tax reform and expanded gambling, both of which are going to take a lot of heavy lifting.
Fellow Republican, House Minority Leader Jeff Hoover was disappointed the governor didn't provide specifics on an expanded gambling proposal. Many educators this winter may lobby for the legalization of casinos, selling them as a much-needed source of revenue for Kentucky schools. As for education, Governor Beshear reiterated last night, if left with no choice, he would be willing to take the needed funds from Peter so Kentucky can pay Paul.
I'm determined to find money to reinvest in education, even if I have to make harmful cuts in other areas to do so.
One of those taking in the State of the Commonwealth address was State Education Commissioner Terry Holliday. Afterwards, Holliday expressed some confidence the legislature will increase funding for schools, but he sees no solid figures on the amount of additional aid which could go into K-12 education.
Every leadership position I've talked to, they all want to support education and restore some of the funds been cut. I think it's just a matter of how much. That's what we'll debate.
Governor Beshear didn't focus on money matters only. He also said the Commonwealth should take steps to protect unmarried couples from domestic violence. When asked about this legislation, Senate President Stivers says current law already provides adequate protection. Governor Beshear will also sponsor an initiative designed to cut the state's smoking rate by 10% by 2018. Another would be to create no-phone zones near schools and construction areas where drivers cannot use cell phones. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
West Virginia Governor Earl Ray Tomlin also delivered his fourth State of the State address. West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara has more.
Governing, like gardening, takes planning, patience, and foresight.
Governor Earl Ray Tomlin addressed a joint meeting of the houses of the legislature, as well as the Supreme Court, Board of Public Works, and dozens of others in the House chamber. With the theme of gardening persisting throughout his speech, working diligently now to ensure a bountiful harvest to come, the governor spoke of his efforts over the past year to create that future. But even in tough economic times for the state, the governor maintains that future is bright.
My fellow West Virginians, make no mistake. The state of our state is strong. We pay our bills on time, and we have invested in our future by continuing to work together as we face future challenges. We will not impose financial burdens on future generations. In fact, our reserve fund is one of the healthiest in the nation.
Tomlin says the state's Revenue Shortfall Reserve Fund, known more commonly as our Rainy Day Fund, has reached its maximum level of $920 million. But now, he and his staff are proposing the legislature use it for its original intent, to balance the state's budget in difficult years. In his budget for state lawmakers, members of the administration say the state will have to make up a $148 million shortfall to meet the constitutional requirement of balancing the budget. Tomlin is proposing legislators take about $84 million from the Rainy Day Fund and allocate it directly to Medicaid, one of the largest burdens on the state's budget and one that continues to grow. Secretary of Revenue Robert Kiss says the additional $64 million shortfall can be made up from shifting excess dollars out of various accounts in state agencies. Even after the announcement of mid-year budget cuts last week, the governor will ask state agencies to again take a 7.5% budget cut in the coming fiscal year, with the exemption of programs like public education, corrections, and juvenile services. Higher education, subject to the full cut last year, will only be asked to cut their budgets at just under 4%, in the hopes a smaller cut will allow colleges and universities to forgo tuition increases. But even with the cuts, the administration still found ways to meet the demands of one strong lobbying group, teachers.
We must invest in our future, sow the seeds for tomorrow, and invest in our children and those called to public service. Therefore, I commit to funding a 2% pay raise for all teachers and school personnel who invest in our children every day.
Tomlin is asking for a 2% pay raise for teachers and school service personnel, as well as a $504 raise for state employees. Both proposed raises are standard in the state budget every 2 years, the last in 2012. Aside from issues of the budget, Tomlin is asking lawmakers to reduce government waste by reforming state purchasing laws and dissolving a number of boards, commissions, and councils he calls obsolete, making interaction with government easier for West Virginians. Education will again be at the top of the governor's proposed legislative agenda as he plans to introduce a number of bills for the legislature's consideration. Tomlin says that legislation will include an emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, as well as career and technical education. He will introduce legislation making the transfer of credits between higher education institutions in the state easier, and is asking the State Board of Education to implement an A through F grading scale for public schools, making it easier for parents and communities to understand school ratings. Overall, the governor's message was one of moving forward, out of a recession and into a brighter future by being fiscally responsible, investing in our children, and supporting small businesses.
I'm also proud of our team, the team right here in this chamber. I'm proud of the work that we have done together. I'm proud of our planning, our patience, our foresight. And I'm proud of the opportunities that we have now have for our children.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
Meanwhile, a coalition working to fight child poverty in West Virginia outlined its goals for this year's session. West Virginia Public Radio's Aaron Payne reports.
The Our Children, Our Future campaign to end child poverty presented 11 issues they want made priority for the upcoming 60-day session and then hand-delivered them to legislators at the Capitol. The coalition was co-founded by the West Virginia Healthy Kids and Families Coalition Executive Director Stephen Smith, who explains the group's ideology is straightforward.
Our goal is very simple. We are a campaign to end child poverty. We think it's obvious that not a kid in our state should have to grow up in poverty.
Each issue was presented with expert and personal testimonies from citizens ranging from students to politicians during a press conference at the Capitol. Smith says that the process to develop the 11 issues began, as always intended, in the communities.
We had two policy forums in July where people could come from all across the state and share ideas. And, you know, at that meeting, there was all kinds of things we were considering. Then we had a policy symposium a month later. We brought everybody from our campaign together for 2 days to hash out what would work and what wouldn't, what was live, what could we win.
After these issues were compiled, the coalition held 72 meetings across the state, asking more than 1,000 West Virginians to vote for the issues they felt were the most important. The group placed 6 issues as top priority, including protecting funding for family support and early childhood programs, and providing in-home family education. Also topping the list is an increase in minimum wage, as well as setting up Senate President Jeff Kessler's proposed future fund from severance taxes. Smith says it would ensure children of today receive benefits from resource extraction. The coalition also suggests a 3-step plan to combat substance abuse that includes dealing with methamphetamine production, offering help with abuse recovery, and helping recovering addicts find employment. They also focus on improving the overall quality of life for children, pregnant workers' fairness, and increasing the tobacco tax by $1 per package. The intrinsic nature of the platform's creation has drawn the attention of state legislators, including Senator Ron Stallings.
I really appreciate the statewide approach and the grassroots approach that that I've seen over the past year. And I love their platform.
Though the movement is gaining traction, Smith acknowledges that the war on child poverty isn't won overnight.
That's going to take a long time, and the way we get there is by chipping away a little bit at a time each year until we can say this is a place where it's the best place in the country for kids to live.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Aaron Payne in Charleston.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Pennsylvania has emerged as the fastest growing state in the nation for natural gas production, with hydraulic fracturing technology unlocking vast amounts of gas in the Marcellus Shale. The state is no stranger to extractive industries like coal and timber. By the early 20th century, its forests were decimated. Today, they've grown back and trees are harvested sustainably. But as Marie Kusick of State Impact Pennsylvania reports, scientists say the surge in gas development is having new kinds of dramatic effects on the forests.
I'm standing on the side of a mountain road trying to avoid a steady stream of heavy truck traffic. Acres of freshly cut tree stumps stretch out in front of me.
This is up here in Tyodotten State Forest, and you're looking at some of the impacts associated with forest fragmentation.
That's Kevin Heatley. He lives in Lycoming County and has come to these woods for years to hike. He's an ecologist by trade who's concerned about what he's seeing. It's called forest fragmentation. It occurs when human development crisscrosses the landscape, carving up large swaths of contiguous forest into smaller pieces.
Everything from the noise and the traffic to the lighting, to the pad placements, to the pipeline construction, to the road expansion. This is all industrial infrastructure. It's inherently incompatible with sustainable forest management.
Healy notes the U.S. Geological Survey has found most of the disturbance in this county from gas drilling is happening in sensitive ecosystems known as core forests.
And that is forest next to forest.
It's very different from so-called edge habitats. That's forest next to something else, like a grassy field or a suburban home. Core forest is rarer, and it's home to species that don't do well near people. Margaret Brittingham is a professor at Penn State who's also studied forest fragmentation. She says when core forest is lost, so are the host of important services its plant and animal species provide.
Insect control, climate control, water purification, you can go on and on. Recreation, aesthetics.
Currently, Pennsylvania has roughly 2 million acres of public forest land. About a third of it is available for oil and gas development.
We are probably currently one of the largest and more active drillers in state forest lands in Pennsylvania.
Rob Boulware is a spokesman for Seneca Resources. He says his company works to minimize forest fragmentation. For example, it tries to use existing roads instead of building new ones. And he points out other industries cut down plenty of trees, too.
If it is a concern, and there are people who will debate and evaluate this, it's a concern for all activity that we are engaged in as humans, and not just the activity that's being engaged in through the oil and gas industry.
But the gas industry is helping to push a new measure that may lead to more forest fragmentation. Drillers are backing a controversial bill that would limit the authority of state agencies to designate endangered species. Boulware argues it's a matter of consistency for businesses. For example, he says companies are sometimes required to conduct expensive and duplicative wildlife surveys before they can begin drilling.
These are little things that companies are looking for that would be cost savings for each individual. And that's what you don't have with the current system.
Republican State Representative Jeff Pyle of Armstrong County is the bill's sponsor. He says the agencies involved in endangered species designations, like the Game Commission, shouldn't hinder economic development.
The problem we have is our missions are conflicting. Their mission is to protect the game species of Pennsylvania. And me as a legislator, part of my mission is to make sure my people don't see widespread unemployment.
Meanwhile, the State Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, which is charged with overseeing public forest land, has spent 4 years and about $8 million on a monitoring program to examine how gas drilling is affecting the forest. To date, none of that information has been made public, but the agency expects to release the initial report in the next few months. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania, Lycoming County.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia on a multimedia, data-driven reporting project covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. A pit filled with fracking water and other waste from oil and gas drilling in Fayette County, West Virginia, does not meet the minimum pit and impoundment standards. As West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly reports, the State Department of Environmental Protection wants the waste pit brought up to minimum standards.
A pit filled with fracking water and other waste from oil and gas drilling in Fayette County does not meet the minimum pit and impoundment standards. The DEP asked Danny Webb Construction to come up with an acceptable plan for the pit. The pit is used to remove sediments from waste before being injected into the nearby underground well in Lot Gully. The permit for the well expired in October of 2012. James Peterson, the underground injection control permit reviewer for the DEP Office of Oil and Natural Gas, says the UIC permit has not been accepted because the nearby sediment pond is not up to code. At a public meeting in June, community members shared concerns over the site. They worried the pit was leaking.
We do not see that it's leaking, but it has been compromised on top just where folks have been walking around the pit.
Peterson says Danny Webb Construction needs to fix the lining of the pit. Without it, he says the pit could leak. The DEP also wants the company to install a leak detection system and denied the first plan. The DEP is now waiting on the company to submit another for review. Danny Webb Construction can still accept waste for the injection well. The company did not immediately return our request for comment. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Lot Gully.
new federal program could allow 8 Southeast Kentucky counties to attract more support in their fight against poverty. The program would create a so-called Promise Zone. The designation could bring more federal money into the region and spawn additional partnerships between government agencies, social service groups, and private employers. Eastern Kentucky University President Michael Benson says his school would also be involved in the initiative.
So we have a chance, really, unique to our campus, given our history in the region, to in partnership with our CARES program and some of the things that we're doing with SOAR, the Shaping Our Appalachian Region, the summit that was held last month. The great equalizer, the great provider of opportunity is going to be access to education. So that's going to be our chief focus, is amplifying the opportunities and enhancing that access.
The University of Kentucky and Berea College are also part of the Promise Zone program. Governor Steve Beshear alluded to the project Tuesday night during the State of the Commonwealth address. This new Promise Zone harkens back to another time, in the 1960s, when President Lyndon Johnson traveled to rural eastern Kentucky to declare a war on poverty. This initiative led to the creation of programs like Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, VISTA, and Job Corps. In 1964, President Johnson traveled to Martin County, Kentucky, to highlight the need in Appalachia for efforts to help people affected by poverty. NPR's Pam Fessler recently went to Martin County to talk with the folks about Johnson's visit and whether the war on poverty has helped.
People in the isolated hills of Martin County, Kentucky, rarely saw outsiders, let alone a president. So Johnson's visit in 1964 was a very big deal. Lee Mueller was a young newspaper reporter. He recalls the crowds in downtown Inez, the county seat, waiting for the presidential party to arrive at an abandoned miniature golf course.
It was just like a hayfield full of long grass, and it looked like helicopters landing in Vietnam or something when they came over the ridge. There were 4 or 5 of them, I think.
He says the locals didn't know their role in this new domestic war, but a government film shows that the White House clearly did.
In this south central mountain country, over a third of the population is faced with chronic unemployment.
It was to give poverty a face and a name.
Typical of this group is Tom Fletcher, his wife and 8 children. Fletcher, an unemployed sawmill operator, earned only $400 last year and has been able to find little employment in the last 2 years.
At the time, the poverty rate in this coal mining area was more than 60%. Johnson visited the Fletchers on the porch of their home, a small wooden structure with fake brick siding. And photographers took what would become one of the iconic images of the war on poverty. The president crouched down, chatting with Tom Fletcher about the lack of jobs. Fast forward 50 years, and some things haven't changed much at all. The Fletcher cabin, for one. It's still standing along a windy road about 5 miles outside of town. It now has wood siding painted orange. There's a metal fence with a no trespassing sign to keep out strangers. There are lots of small houses and trailers along this road, but also some new, bigger homes that could be found in any American suburb. In downtown, Inez has some new offices and a big bank. Roads are well paved, and people say the schools and hospitals here are a lot better than they used to be. Still, Martin County remains one of the poorest counties in the country. Its poverty rate is 35%, more than twice the national average. Unemployment is high. Only 9% of the adults have a college degree. Much of the poverty today is tucked between the mountains in what are called the hollers.
Hi. How are you?
We were up on that.
Hi, I'm Norma.
Norma Moore greets visitors from Appalachia Reach Out, a faith-based charity that helps the area's poor. Moore cares for her 8-year-old grandson, Braden. She says his parents didn't want him, that he was born with a rare blood disease and is severely disabled.
And they said he was dying. And then at 4 months, I got him. And I've had him ever since.
Braden doesn't talk or walk, but he's in constant motion, rolling on the floor of their double-wide trailer home, bumping into walls and doors.
Come on. Come in here now, Mommy. Come on.
There's no question that Moore's life is incredibly stressful. She says she gets by on her faith, but here's where the war on poverty has also made a big difference. Today, she gets food stamps, supplemental security income for her grandson, and energy assistance to heat her home. She shakes her head thinking about life without it.
I would be homeless. I would be the one living on the street if it wasn't for that.
She looks down at her grandson on the floor.
He would probably be in a home somewhere.
Today, many people here rely on government aid. In fact, it's the largest source of income in Martin County. People say it's helped reduce hunger, improved health care, and given young families a boost, especially at a time when coal mining jobs are disappearing by the hundreds.
Get your body moving. Get your body moving.
Children in a Head Start class skip across the lunchroom in a nearby school. This is one of the signature programs of the War on Poverty, helping low and moderate income children get ready for school. Budget cuts are always a concern here. Some of these children get their only hot meal of the day here at school.
My name is Delcy Fletcher. I am a family service worker at Martin County Head Start.
Fletcher helps Head Start parents with services, such as getting their high school diplomas, so maybe they can get a better job. And yes, Delcy's one of those Fletchers, married to one of the children who stood on the porch with President Johnson. I'm curious how the war on poverty has helped her husband's family, if at all. Turns out, along with the famous photo, it's a sore topic.
They don't like to talk about it because, you know, they don't want to be known as the poorest family in Martin County.
And she says they probably weren't, that most of the Fletchers have done okay for themselves. Still, it hasn't been easy. Her husband had some of his toes cut off when he worked in the sawmills, and now he's on disability. Work around here can be tough and dangerous, which is why coal mining jobs pay so well. But now they're scarce, and there's nothing to replace them, so people are struggling to adjust.
My name is Thomas Vinson, and I've been a resident of Martin County for 41 years, and I work in the coal fields, and I'm unemployed right now.
Vinson says he has a big house payment and three sons to raise.
You know, times is tough, but, you know, we're making it.
One reason is Vincent's wife got a job at a gear factory through a federally funded program to help unemployed miners. Vincent's grateful for the short-term help, but worried about his future. Overall, he's disappointed in the war on poverty. He says he sees too many people around here just collecting checks. And to what end?
They call it poverty, but I call it abusing the system. You know, like if you're going to file out for SSI, you go in there and say the right things, you'll come out of there with a check.
His feelings are widespread around here. What good are all these government programs if they don't get you a job? Mike Howell runs the local community action program, where the Vincents came for help. The program's a direct result of the war on poverty. Howell agrees that the war has yet to achieve its goals, but says the reason is a lack of support, that the burst of enthusiasm after President Johnson's visit has waned. Every year, his program has to fight for funds.
We have kind of let poverty go to the side. It's still way too high. Somebody asked me one time about the war on poverty. I said, well, it really wasn't a war. It's more of a skirmish. And we need to declare war on poverty again.
One, he says, that goes back to Johnson's original goal, which was to help people not only survive, but to thrive.
Our aim is not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it. And above all, to prevent it.
Colby Kirk is the kind of young man who would make a parent proud. Polite, smart, focused. He's a junior at the University of Kentucky, studying to be a financial analyst.
I'm really interested in, like, assessing risk and doing cash flows. It's not something most people, I guess, are interested in, but it's always struck my fancy, so...
He'd also like to come back here someday to his hometown of Inez, Kentucky, nestled in the mountains of Appalachia. We're sitting in the stands of the high school football field beneath one of those mountains, not far from where President Johnson came in 1964. Kirk says he knows things are a lot better here than they were back then.
You know, paved roads, everyone's got a car. There's a half of a McDonald's right there.
He points to a nearby gas station. Still,
there's not really any opportunities for college grads back here unless you make your own. It's really hard to do that if you're a financial analyst.
I would say one of our biggest exports is, you know, bright young minds.
Michelle Harless is the guidance counselor at the local high school. She says she sees it all the time. The best and the brightest leave Martin County, and those who stay and don't go to college often end up in dead-end minimum-wage jobs.
20 years ago, they went to the coal mines. My dad graduated high school and went to the coal mines. He is a maintenance supervisor in West Virginia, and I'll never make as much money as he does.
Even though she has a college degree. But those high-paying jobs are disappearing like an early morning fog. Hundreds of miners here have been laid off recently, and there are no jobs to replace them.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Big Sandy Area Community Action. This is Kayla. May I help you?
Which means lots of people here have had to turn for help to some of the many government programs that were spawned by the war on poverty. Food stamps, Medicaid, heating assistance for their homes. The poverty rate in Martin County is lower than it was when President Johnson was here, but it's still 35%, more than twice the national average.
Okay, ma'am, you're here to get help with a kerosene voucher today, is that correct?
Yes.
And you state that this is your address as shown on your service bill?
Yes, it is.
Today, more than half the income in this county comes from government payments rather than from wages and salaries.
In my opinion, you can never get out of poverty if you don't have a job.
Mike Howell runs this community action program. He says many more people here would be struggling without the war on poverty, but that it's only helped them so much.
And it can't just be minimum wage jobs. It can't be jobs that just will barely get you by. But in order to get those jobs, people have to have the education to be able to do those jobs.
This program provides some of that education and training, but getting funding is a constant challenge, and there have to be jobs to fill. So this area, like many across the country, is grappling with how to attract new businesses. State and local leaders say they need more highways and broadband access to bring technology, tourism, and factory jobs to this isolated region.
People in Martin County perform very well. We have very high-skilled laborers.
Mike Duncan is chairman and CEO of a local bank and also a former chairman of the Republican National Committee. He's concerned about all the talent leaving and has offered internships to students like Colby Kirk in the hopes that they, like him, will eventually settle in Inez. Duncan says the war on poverty has been a mixed blessing for this area's economic growth. It's improved health and lifted many Appalachians out of poverty.
But there have been some problems, too. There's, in some instances, a lack of self-reliance. I think the entitlement mentality has done away with some things that I consider very strong Appalachian values. Sometimes it's more difficult to get casual laborers today.
Especially, he says, for lower-paying jobs, although others complain that those jobs pay too little to live on. Colby Kirk hopes that people here find a solution soon. He says a local newspaper editor used to ask one question repeatedly, what will we do when the coal is gone? Kirk thinks too few people here took that question seriously until now.
Do you think the country needs another war on poverty?
I think we should reevaluate our war strategy, at least.
He thinks today it's not so much about feeding families as it was 50 years ago, but about giving young people hope. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. If you've ever driven through Randolph County, West Virginia on U.S. Route 219, you've probably passed the towns of Daly, East Daly, and Valley Bend, just 10 miles south of Elkins. Most folks probably don't realize that these towns have a unique history behind them. The Tigert Valley Homestead was built in the 1930s as part of a larger government project to provide relief to unemployed and stranded families during the Great Depression. Traveling 219's Dan Schultz has more.
If you go to the website of the Library of Congress, you can browse through dozens of black and white photographs depicting rural life in the Tigert Valley in Randolph County, West Virginia, in the 1930s and 40s. The photos portray almost every aspect of life in the communities that made up the Tigert Valley homestead. Busy men working in a woodworking shop, a meeting of a women's club, children in a nursery. Many of the photos depict the landscape of the valley, scattered with uniform-looking, pristine Cape Cod-style homes and buildings of modern industry among the farmland and distant mountains. Today, you can still find many of these original buildings if you're driving by on U.S. Route 219. But before the 1930s, none of this was here. The valley was a sparsely populated wetland when the federal government initiated a new program designed to relocate struggling and impoverished families to new communities under a unique vision during the Great Depression. Jerry Thomas is a retired professor of history from Shepherd University. Jerry has focused a lot of his work on West Virginia during the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Most influenced by Quaker ideas, the dream was that workers or farmers placed on productive agricultural land could raise crops and food for subsistence and also work in nearby industries or industries that they themselves could generate. They would always have enough food, and if the industrial work was slow to recover in the area, they or their families could get together and engage in handicrafts to generate cash income.
Josephine Vanskoy grew up at the homestead after her family was selected for the new relief program.
Oh yes, they started that 1934 selecting them for the homestead. And it was 298 or 300 people selected for the houses that they were going to build. And everybody had to help. And they made about 30 or 40 cents an hour.
Josephine's father, Frank, was a carpenter who had worked for the CCC and at a lumber mill in the neighboring county. Homesteaders were chosen partly for their work experience, since they would be employed in constructing the homestead homes and the community buildings. The homestead had been envisioned as a cooperative community, and a 550-acre cooperative farm was established there in 1935. A handsome stone trade center, which today houses the local post office, was also constructed to help residents participate in trade for the products they produced at the homestead.
And then they did have a weaving shop here where the women came down here daily and wove articles. They wove rugs, scarves, aprons, and then the men had a woodworking shop down here daily where they made items, small items, and they taught men to do those things for their own home. See, they finally built a mill over here, and a lot of the men went to work in mills.
The lumber mill was one of the biggest successes of the Tiger Valley homestead. The federal government built 99 other planned communities around the country during the 1930s, and many other homesteads failed to attract industry to their communities, which was a large component of the initial vision for the self-sustaining homestead projects. At Tiger Valley, the lumber mill employed 150 residents and helped reinvigorate the timber industry in the area. Despite this, from the beginning, there was a lot of opposition to the whole idea of a government-funded and sponsored homestead community project. Many people saw the project as utopian and a waste of resources.
Also, the political opposition was intense. Many businessmen believed it inappropriate for government to promote industrial activities in competition with existing businesses. And generally, the business community thought that this whole idea of a subsistence homestead smacked of socialism. With the coming of World War II, the government quickly rid itself of the properties and went out of the subsistence homestead business.
In the 1940s, after only 10 years, the homestead community and trade buildings were sold off, and residents were able to buy their homes for around $3,000, when the national average home price was closer to $10,000. From the proceeds of these sales, the community was able to repay the federal government the sum of their entire loans over the homestead's 10-year existence. This makes the Tiger Valley Homestead one of the success stories of the homestead experiments, as well as the New Deal project in general. But for folks like Josephine Vanskoy, who never left Tiger Valley, the homestead was about more than numbers. It was about improving the lives of American families in some of the hardest-hit places in the midst of the worst economic disaster in the nation's history, about pulling people together and giving them a chance to build their own communities and work towards owning their own homes.
See, we had running water and electric and a big garden, and men had steady work, and they helped build their own homes, which they were proud of. I'm not ashamed of being a Taggers Valley homesteader because my parents was seven children and he didn't have much work and we were renting and we didn't have a whole lot and we were one of the few selected.
This story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more, go to traveling219.com or Facebook. This is a tough time of the year for food banks because after the holiday season, donations tend to dwindle. West Virginia Public Radio's Clark Davis reports the Junior League of Huntington and Huntington Area Food Bank are hosting a month-long drive to stock the shelves.
The Huntington Area Food Bank services an area that covers 12 counties in West Virginia, 4 in Kentucky, and 1 in Ohio. Erin Highlander is Director of Development. She says drives like these are crucial. Highlander says one of the most important places to take donations is at the grocery store.
If the barrel is right there at the door at the grocery store and all you have to do is pick up a can as you go through, you've done something for your community and it didn't cost you an arm and a leg. And so these are great opportunities, again, to get more people involved and get more people understanding what we do and how we work.
Highlander says the new management of the Huntington Area Food Bank took over a year ago November. And after a tough winter last year where donations were slim, they looked for ideas like the month-long drive to create more inventory at a time when it's tougher for the program.
The soup drive was actually kind of what came out of learning from last winter. We didn't have a lot of donations. We really needed the help, and we really needed a way to get in front of people. And we all have to go to the grocery store, so it really helped to say, well, why don't we find a way to combine those elements?
Highlander says the holidays combined with the recent bad weather tends to increase the need at pantries and soup kitchens. She says facilities like the Huntington City Mission have likely had more visitors in the last week because of temperatures and will need additional food quicker than usual.
Agencies have that option. If you're an agency who's only open once a month, then you don't need to come every day. But if you're somebody like the soup kitchen, you may have a need to get online, order food, and pick food up on a constant rotation. And that's the upside is we try to accommodate all the different agencies and their needs on a day-to-day basis.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Each fall, states choose their Teacher of the Year. That teacher is then eligible to be considered for National Teacher of the Year. Kentucky's Teacher of the Year is Holly Bloodworth, who teaches third grade in Murray. Pennsylvania's choice, Anthony Grizzillo, comes from Delaware County and teaches kindergarten through fifth grade gifted students. Virginia's Teacher of the Year, Melissa Porfirio, is a first grade instructor from Fairfax County near Washington, D.C. And in Tennessee, high school calculus teacher Wanda Napier-Lacey from Knoxville was chosen. West Virginia's Teacher of the Year is Erin Spinoggle from Berkeley County, who incorporates her unique last name into the lessons she teaches her fifth grade students.
The Choctaw were the first to leave in 1831, followed by the Creek in 1834, the Chickasaw in 1837, and the Cherokee in 1838.
Students in Erin Spinoggle's fifth grade class are learning about the Trail of Tears when the United States government forced thousands of Native Americans from their homeland in the Southeast to go to Oklahoma. Spinoggle incorporates technology in the lesson, first showing a video, then having the children analyze a painting of the event.
Shelby?
It shows their depression on some of the faces, like they look all sad and stuff.
Okay, think about how you would feel if you had to get up and leave your home. And
in the final exercise of this lesson, the children work in groups to create their own artwork, depicting what they think it might have been like for members of the Indian tribes making the long trek across half the country to a place they've never been before.
Now, your artwork does not have to necessarily be the painting that you saw. It could be something that has symbols in it.
Teacher of the Year is an award like no other. It's not a shelfie. It's not just something that you sit on a shelf and you admire.
Sponaugle will take on additional duties as Teacher of the Year that include speaking engagements, space camp in July, and attending a convention in Arizona. She could also be considered for the National Teacher of the Year, which will be announced in April. This is Sponaugle's 11th year in the classroom. She's a graduate of Shepherd University who briefly majored in mass communications before she was inspired to become a teacher. It is an unlikely career choice because she suffers from anxiety disorder.
You know, dealing with having panic attacks, and, you know, that's a big leap. There were times my first year of 2 years of teaching that I would just turn to the chalkboard. We had chalkboards back then, not smart boards or dry erase boards or any of that. But, and I just thought, what am I doing? I can't do this. My life is over. I've ruined it. There's no way I'm going to be able to beat this.
But Sponaugle did beat it.
If you are a Native American, though, and you are being asked to leave your land, what's your point of view? Why do you think, how do you feel this, and why do you feel that way?
Watching her in front of the classroom, talking with ease to the children as she prompts them to figure out what it must have been like for those Native Americans forced to walk more than 2,000 miles to a strange place.
I'm very fortunate for what I've been able to do. And like I said, it's something that I had to practice. Like, I had to really work on speaking and work on being in front of people. But I really wanted to be a teacher, and I really felt drawn to working with children and doing good things for kids.
As she discussed the day's lessons with her students, Sponaugle's love of teaching is evident. She tries to incorporate not only technology, but creativity into the lessons, and that includes making use of her last name. While other students at Tomahawk Intermediate learn vocabulary words, her students work on spocabulary. That brief training in college mass communications also comes in handy.
You know, there's a big emphasis on testing and making sure that on, you know, paper they're marking the right answers, or that our scores are going up. But it's also important to give kids time to create and be and use their imagination. So I have something called Spoductions, which are our own classroom productions where our students work together to create scripts about what we're learning and to record themselves and add, you know, create their own music and background effects to showcase something that they've learned that they can access and share with other students.
And her students get some real-world experience through their Sponomics lesson.
It's our classroom economy where they have jobs and they earn a paycheck each week and they keep a transaction log like a checking account. And it ties into, they get to spend their money at a, you know, on our classroom store, but they also have to pay rent, and there's different fees, and there are some months where I have to institute a talking tax or a, you know, special book debit because things are being left on the floor. But they get into it because they get kind of emotional when they get that rent bill. It's like, oh, we have to pay for that. That's coming out of my paycheck. And they turn into these little mini adults about it.
Sponomics includes having an interest-bearing savings account and, in April, paying taxes.
So they do their classroom taxes, and they get to do deductions if they've read so many accelerated reader points or whatever. I make it complicated, so they have to really sit there and be like they would if they were in the real world.
Sponaugle uses old-fashioned games like Scrabble in her classroom, but she also loves incorporating technology and showing other teachers how to use it.
And that's what I'm hoping to continue to do as Teacher of the Year, is share with other people throughout the state that work with our students on a variety of levels how you can use technology, how you can use the...
Buses 135, 58, and 136 are now dismissed. Buses 135, 58, and 136 are now dismissed.
How you can use the web to connect students to the rest of the world.
As Berkeley County Teacher of the Year, Sponaugle has also been trying to let the rest of the world know more about the people who work with their children.
Hello, I'm Erin Sponaugle here today at South Middle School. Join me today as we learn about some of the teachers here at the home of the Trojans on this edition of Be the Difference West Virginia.
She created a YouTube channel called Be the Difference. She's in the process of conducting videotaped interviews with two teachers from each school in the county, having them talk about why they teach.
I want them to get the emotional aspect of teaching, most importantly, because these teachers, they start talking about why they decided to become teachers and what they enjoy about working with children, And it's very moving. Maybe it's just because I'm a teacher myself, but you know, teaching is a very selfless profession. And people give up hours of their personal time. There are summers that aren't really off and have gone above and beyond professionally to make themselves as educated as they can about what they do.
Spinago wants people who watch the videos to come away with a better understanding of the profession and to realize there are some amazing teachers working with their children. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, the Allegheny Front and Kentucky Public Radio, as well as West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Jessica Lilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.